Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Markovitz, the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School and the author of The Meritocracy Trap. In his book, Dr. Markovitz challenges the overwhelmingly dominant notion that American meritocracy is a well-functioning mechanism that efficiently offers opportunities based upon an individual's ability and effort. Dr. Markovitz, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure and privilege to be here.
So as I read your book, I learned a lot about your own educational career and academic career, and I realized that you are, by every definition, a meritocrat. You went to public schools and come from a middle-class family, but you also rose to attend some of the very best schools in the world. So despite your own successes navigating America's meritocratic system, what motivated you to critically explore America's meritocracy?
Great. Thank you very much for that question. I should, first of all, just clarify. I did go to middle-class public schools in Austin, Texas. And there's a sense in which my background is middle-class, but my parents were professionals. And so I say that partly just to set the record straight, but also partly to answer your question, which is that the schools that I went to were full of extremely gifted kids whose parents did not have either the income or the education that my parents did. And I remember sitting in calculus class with these kids or in history class, and it's being very obvious to me that they could understand things that I couldn't understand. So there were ways in which they were better students than I was in high school. And yet they didn't end up going to Yale College or to Oxford or to Yale Law School as I did. And it was always very vivid in me, well, why did that happen? What's the account of this difference in outcomes, given that at 15, you know, the, as it were, meritocratic rank order could just as well have been reversed. And getting to the bottom of that and understanding how that happened was part of the motivation for writing the book.
So you take a unique approach to examining meritocracy, whereas most critics look at the unfairness or what we might think of as the myth of meritocracy. Your argument builds on this, but further argues that even for those who win in America's meritocratic system, the outcomes aren't always optimal. So you describe this contradiction as the meritocracy trap. So what are the characteristics of the meritocracy trap?
Great. I think that there are two ways in which my view is unconventional. The first has to do with what's the best explanation for the structural exclusion of most middle and working class Americans from elite education, from all the advantages and the economic opportunities that come with it. So that's the first. I have a different account of the structural exclusion. I'll say something about that in a minute. The second, as you mentioned, is the question whether those who appear to win in this system actually win. I also have the view that even those who seem to win don't really win in human terms. So let me say something about each of those. Start with the structural exclusion point. The conventional wisdom is that the reason why there is so much structural exclusion, why it's the case that there's relatively less social mobility, say, in the United States than in Northern European countries, why it's the case that kids who go to poor or even middle-class schools have a vanishingly small chance of ending up at a place like Harvard, is that meritocracy is false, that it's a scam, that elites cheat to get ahead, that legacy preferences give alumni children an advantage in admission, and that if you're rich enough, your parents can buy you a slot at Harvard. And it's not that I deny that those things are the case. Those things are obviously the case. They're real, they're scandalous, they're shameful. But I think if one looks at the numbers, those are not the dominant cause of structural exclusion. So the dominant cause of structural exclusion isn't that meritocracy isn't operating as advertised. It's that meritocracy is operating as advertised. That is to say, it's true that legacy preferences make it easier to get into Harvard if your parents went to Harvard. But it's also true that the legacy kids who go into Harvard have extremely good grades and extremely high test scores. And that it's very, very hard if you go to an ordinary high school to compete on the merits with kids who go to Andover or Ethical Culture Fieldston or Pali or Gunn or Nutrier or Scarsdale High or any number of extremely rich, extremely elite public and private schools, and that that's meritocracy working as designed to produce a kind of social exclusion. So there's an empirical point there, and there's also a conceptual point. The conceptual point is that we must distinguish between meritocracy and equality of opportunity. That equality of opportunity holds when people have the same chance of success wherever they start. Meritocracy holds when people get ahead based on their accomplishments. But if rich kids have much more invested in their training than other kids, and training works, then when you advantage people based on their accomplishments meritocratically, you will precisely violate equality of opportunity. So that's the first sense in which my view is, I think, unusual or unconventional. The second sense goes to what you asked in your question, which is, does this benefit the winners, the kids who go to Ethical Culture Fieldston, or who go to Dalton in New York, or who go to Phillips Exeter Academy? And the story I want to tell there is that this system, because being privileged is a necessary condition for staying ahead, but not a sufficient condition, puts enormous strain on those kids who have to constantly study, constantly prepare for tests, constantly be evaluated, constantly bend their interests and their characters to suit the tastes of those who will measure them. They then get into a fancy college. They keep working to get into a fancy professional school. They then get into a fancy professional school, Harvard Business School, to Yale Law School. They work very hard there, and then they get a job at Cravath or at McKinsey or at Goldman Sachs, where they work 80, 90 hours a week in order to make partner. And then when they make partner, they still work 80, 90 hours a week. And this is not a form of human flourishing. This is alienated labor that is extremely damaging to the people who yield it. So meritocracy, in my view, excludes most people and ensnares even those who seem to get ahead.
It's really interesting that despite some of these harmful effects that come from meritocracy, you mentioned quite a few times that the charm of meritocracy sort of protects it from its critics. So I'm wondering what characteristics of meritocracy continue to protect it from critique, and sort of connecting this back to education policy and thinking about equal educational opportunity for different groups, how are these characteristics bolstered by arguments that a meritocratic system creates greater access for educational and career opportunities for groups such as people of color, or women, or people with disabilities that have been historically excluded or marginalized?
Yeah, so I think there's a historical story there, and there's kind of an ideological story. The historical story is that one of the things that meritocracy was embraced to do in the United States, say at Harvard first, but then at the University of California, eventually at places like Princeton and Yale, and also, by the way, in England and in France with the Grande École, was precisely to break an aristocratic elite. The idea was that elite families passed their privilege down through the generations simply by birthright. You inherited your parents' titles. You inherited your name, and that was all you needed to be at the top. And that was correctly viewed as extremely unfair, and also kind of wasteful and inefficient, because it meant that all sorts of lazy and incompetent people nevertheless had high social status and a lot of power. Meritocracy was invented to break that up, and it did break that up. And so part of the charisma of meritocracy is the holdover of its early successes at breaking up an unjustified, ineffectual aristocratic elite. A second part of the charisma is that even today, we have the correct sense that natural talent and effort don't belong to any privileged subgroup. And so if we allow people to work their way up, all sorts of people who are traditionally excluded will be advantaged because they'll be able to get there using the resource they have, which is themselves. And meritocracy will reward that. And part of the problem is that's not false. You know, it is in fact true, for example, that meritocracy has given us a much more diverse, much more multi-ethnic, multicultural elite class in America than we used to have. The managing partner of Cravath, Swain & Moore, probably the most elite law firm in America, is now a woman of color. That would have been impossible under the old aristocracy. More generally, actually, if you look at, there's a great paper in the Quarterly Journal of Economics by a guy who's now the dean of Yale's business school and a co-author, which shows that if you look at the entire distribution and you look at the white-black earnings gap, the white-black earnings gap for African-Americans at the top of the African-American distribution has shrunk. And meritocracy produces that result. That is to say, meritocracy means that the exceptional individual can get ahead regardless of caste or class or race or gender. And that's a great moral achievement. On the other hand, because meritocracy means that elites who invest a lot in their children can privilege their children, meritocracy also means that across the distribution, people who are more ordinary and in more ordinary circumstances are structurally excluded and massively disadvantaged. So that, for example, if college admissions were based on the SAT alone, colleges, especially elite colleges, would be richer and whiter. And that's because rich people and white people and people who have various forms of privilege are really good at training their children to do well on the SAT. And what that means is that that kind of competitive merit-based, I'm putting scare quotes with my hands now, you can't see me, competition means that those who have get more. So the very same features of meritocracy that mean that it opens up an elite to people who would otherwise be outsiders in exceptional cases mean also that it closes off advantage to people who are not privileged in the run of cases. And that conflict means that meritocracy is hard to criticize.
So you dedicate a chapter of your book to going over the various resources that different students are afforded dependent upon their socioeconomic status at birth. You describe, for example, that children born into families of the meritocratic elite are placed early on onto paths that are nurturing every single step of the way and their trajectory into some of the most prestigious schools in the country, whether that be high school or into college. So what are some of the examples that you found to best highlight the different experiences that children from different families may have been afforded? And in your view, what does this mean for equal educational opportunity going forward?
Yeah, let me give a sort of a top line observation, and then I'll give some more concrete examples. And the top line observation specifically for your listeners, you know, your listeners are going to know a lot. Many of them will probably even know more than I do about, say, school finance equalization litigation and the effort to reduce inequality in the investments in schools across different economic classes or racial classes in the U.S. The critical thing about that project, which is incredibly important, incredibly admirable, is that it focuses on reducing the gap between the poor and the middle class. And that gap has, in fact, been reduced. It hasn't been eliminated. It remains the case that in the public education system, the U.S. is one of the very few rich countries that spends more per person on rich students than on poor students, which is a scandal. But it is the case that the gap between what gets invested in a poor kid or a kid of color in education and what gets invested in a middle-class white kid is smaller today than it was 50, 60 years ago. What I focus on in the meritocracy trap, though, is a different gap, which is a gap between the middle class and the rich. And that gap is enormous and has exploded. So that, you know, the median public school in the United States spends, if we're talking very round numbers, $15,000 per pupil per year on education. The richest schools in America, the most elite schools, just pick, if you want to pick a convention, the schools on the Forbes list of the 20 best private schools in America, those average north of $75,000 per pupil per year. That gap is the resource gap that is getting rich kids to stay ahead. Because those schools also, of course, overwhelmingly have very, very rich students in them. maybe 80% come from the top 4% of the income distribution on average at those schools. And that gap is so big and so dramatic that the techniques that are used to reduce the poor middle class gap cannot be used to reduce the middle class rich gap. It's just too big. And at the same time, we have an economy in which income gains and rewards are being increasingly concentrated in just this narrow elite. So that the view, oh, it doesn't matter what a few rich kids get, is no longer true, because what those few rich kids are getting, what the 1% is getting, is almost all of the income growth in the whole society over the past 40 or 50 years. And that's the story that the book tells. It tells about the incredibly elite preschools that these kids go to, the extravagant investments in music lessons, in supplemental tutoring that these kids get. You know, there are now tutors in New York for high school kids that are paid $1,000 an hour to prepare high school kids in academic subjects. Those sorts of stories and the way in which those investments that only rich people can afford pay enormous returns when it comes to applying to college or later on looking for professional opportunities.
So building on both of the last questions, one where you started to talk about how meritocracy was created to do away with aristocracy, and the last question where you sort of provided examples that reflected sort of the differences in opportunities that certain students are afforded. You argue that meritocracy has actually begun to resemble aristocracy because of the elite resources that are afforded to a small group of students. So how does the private educational opportunity offered by families begin to resemble the inheritance of dynastic wealth that that was observed during times of aristocracy? And how is this problem of passing on sort of this human capital through elite educational training exacerbated by the fact that education is always going to be a positional good?
Great. So there are three ways in which this analogy is powerful. The first concerns what might be called the dynastic technology. That is to say, how do elite families pass their privilege down through the generations? Aristocrats did it simply by dying and then leaving their estates and their titles to their children, so that the adult children acquired their parents' wealth and privilege and social status when the parents died. The way meritocrats do this is by investing incredible amounts, the amounts we just discussed, in their children, in the human capital of their children, while the parents are still alive. And one way to think about this is if you take the difference between what a typical 1% family invests in its children's education and what's invested in a typical middle-class child, not a poor child, a middle-class child, and imagine that in every year of the child's life, you took that difference and you put it into a trust fund to invest in the S&P 500 to be given to the child as an inheritance on the death of the parents. That is to say, you mimic the old aristocratic way of passing privilege down. And you took that amount would be north of $10 million per child. So that gives you a sense for the extent of the dynastic transmission of privilege that meritocratic inequality achieves. That's point one. Point two is that for the old aristocrats, the thing that was the source of your wealth, if you were in the elite, was land or factories or portfolios of stock, so physical or financial capital. Today's elite, the source of their wealth is their own human capital. You know, it used to be almost impossible to make an extravagant income by working. You could tell how poor someone was by how hard they worked for almost all of human history. Whereas today, if you have the right training, the right skills, and are willing to work incredibly hard, as a lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, as a banker at Goldman, as an elite executive at GE, you can make $5 million, $10 million, or even $100 million a year in exchange for your labor. So that in the old aristocratic regime, what rich parents did is they gave their children estates, and estates were the source of wealth. Whereas today, what meritocrats do is they give their children educations, and educations are the source of wealth. So that's the second analogy. And the third analogy is systemic and legal. The legal order of the aristocracy had a whole series of technical rules in place to stabilize the passing of privilege down through the generations so that aristocratic families wouldn't end up losing their privilege. For example, there was an idea called the fee tail. Aristocratic estates were entailed, which meant that if people borrowed against their estates, the creditors could not foreclose, so that even if one generation was wasteful, the other generation would still inherit the land. So this was a way in which the legal system privileged aristocratic families by keeping land in the family. Well, in our system, here are two similar rules that privilege meritocrats. First of all, if I'm incredibly rich and spend millions of dollars on my children's education, that's exempted from every tax. It's exempted from the inheritance tax. It's exempted from the estate and gift tax. So there's a massive tax subsidy in the form of the tax-free transfer that I can make to my children if I pay for their education. That subsidy is only increased by the fact that elite private schools and universities are all organized as tax-exempt organizations, which means that alumni donations are tax-deductible to the alumni, and the schools and universities can invest their endowments tax-free. And the extent of that public subsidy, again, which goes overwhelmingly to the very rich children, is enormous. Princeton University's tax exemption, someone recently estimated, is worth about $100,000 per pupil per year in public subsidy paid by the rest of society to Princeton students, over half of whom are from the top 1% of the income distribution. To give you a comparison point, State University of New Jersey at Rutgers spends about $12,500 per pupil per year, and Essex County Community College spends maybe $2,500 per pupil per year. So the subsidy that the public gives to the incredibly rich kids at Princeton is 40 times as much as the subsidy that the public gives to middle-class kids or working-class kids at the local community college. And that's, again, like an aristocracy, the system is set up to privilege the elite, particularly in its practice of passing its own privilege down to its children.
So given your findings, do you have any recommendations for your readers, or do you have any recommendations for how we might move forward given America's meritocratic system?
Yeah, I have two kinds of recommendations, and then maybe a more of a political thought. The two policy recommendations are, if the basic mechanisms that have wound up this inequality concern concentrated elite education and concentrated opportunities for work for elite workers, to unwind it, we have to dilute both of those concentrations. So schools, start there, should be required to open themselves up to many, many more students and overwhelmingly to middle class and working class students. All private schools and all private universities and all elite public schools and public universities should be required to educate twice, maybe three times as many students, and to take almost all the new students from outside of the elite. That would be feasible. The Ivy League spends almost twice as much per pupil per year as it did in 2000. There's no reason it can't have twice as many students and still deliver a serious education. And it would be easy to require them to do it simply by changing the tax laws so that universities or schools, you know, a school like Ethical Culture Fieldston Preschool, that didn't double its enrollments and didn't educate a student body whose economic profile looked like the country's, would lose its tax exemption. There's no reason why the rest of society should subsidize schools that educate only rich kids. And that combination would massively open up elite education, create many, many more opportunities, and of course, reduce the extreme and extravagant value that elite education has for those who have it, because there'd be more people who have it. On the labor market side, tax policy, labor market policy, industrial policy, technology policy should all favor mid-skilled, middle-class labor. And there are a variety of ways to do that. The most straightforward one is to lift the cap on the Social Security wage tax, which now means that people who get paid $2 million a year pay a lower aggregate tax than people who get paid $100,000 a year. And in fact, that middle-class labor is the highest taxed commodity in our entire economy. And in a world in which we have massive economic inequality and a struggling middle class, putting a tax burden on precisely those who are struggling is a crazy piece of policy. So those are some policy examples. The last thing I think I want to say is on the politics of it. You mentioned earlier that it's part of the view of the meritocracy trap that even the rich are suffering under this system. And that's incredibly important because high-end economic inequality, concentrated wealth, are very, very hard to unwind. And they're hard to unwind because rich people resist redistribution. But if the rich can be persuaded that the system as it stands is harming them, and that if they gave up a little bit of privilege and income that they can easily afford to lose, they would recover their freedom, their authentic choice, a non-alienated life world for themselves, then the politics of redistribution become much more favorable. And that's when we can start talking practically about the policies that we need to implement in order actually to achieve more equality in our society.
Thank you, Dr. Markovitz. This book is a fundamental resource for understanding how American meritocracy operates today. It exposes the contradictions that lie between the rhetoric used by advocates of meritocracy and the realities experienced by those most affected by America's meritocratic regime. Again, Dr. Markovitz's book is The Meritocracy Trap. As always, thanks for listening. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.